In order to understand why Bitcoin works, one of the things that we really need to have a clear image of in our minds, of the role that it plays in Bitcoin, is the hash function. The hash is one of the most fundamental tools of the Bitcoin system, and proof of work is the most powerful way to use this tool. This is the second episode in the Bitcoin Basics series, Hashes and Proofs of Work. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are getting back to the basics today. I've got a couple of really great reads lined up, I wanted to make sure that I do the basics episodes pretty regularly, and I got a couple of you guys with feedback and specific questions that you wanted me to cover. And just so you know, I really appreciate it because it's good for me to have your perspective. Like, I'm totally doing the basics episode to basics episode series to answer the questions, the curiosities that you still have, the things that don't really get covered on this show because we're just deep in the woods talking about Keat and Noster and, you know, Taproot and blah, blah, blah. So shoot me a question. If you want me to break something, I will literally basically break down anything that is of Bitcoin relatedness on the show at some point in the basics episodes, because that's what they're for. And I do want to keep a lot of this high level because this is really about understanding how to use and interact with Bitcoin and kind of understanding the relative importance of the different pieces of Bitcoin so that you just know what you're looking at when you look at Bitcoin, when you use Bitcoin, and so that it is familiar. You know, it doesn't feel clunky and hard to make sense out of. So if you have a good framing and you understand the basics, you'll have a good time in Bitcoin. If you don't understand the basics, you're gonna have a bad time. So listen to the Bitcoin Basics series on Bitcoin Audible and share it out with other people, because this is the whole point of this. If people don't listen to it and they don't get any value out of it, then it defeats the purpose. I want to answer your questions, and I want this to be a great onboarding for people who feel intimidated. Now, not unfortunately, because this is such a cool thing. I love hashes and proof of work. This is one of the most interesting tricks of cryptography and things that you see all the time, and that will give you a whole new image of the entire internet, your computer, networking and everything, if you didn't really know much about it beforehand. However, it is probably the most technical thing that we will cover. Everything else, public-private keys are a little bit easier because you can just use a simple analogy. But hashing is so ubiquitous in Bitcoin and in just kind of a lot of things that you do kind of have to understand some really important characteristics about it. There's a decent analogy that a hash is a fingerprint of the data, like of, you know, a hash of a PDF is just a fingerprint of that PDF so that you know you're getting the right PDF. But there's a couple of really critical characteristics that make a lot of the main functions that you see come up all the time in Bitcoin and that recur over and over, and some of the fundamental ways that you even want to think about the pieces of Bitcoin. And you have to know those characteristics, and saying it's a fingerprint doesn't really give you that whole picture. So the one thing that I want us to be familiar with is hashing and hashes, because you can deduce a lot about Bitcoin from just understanding how it uses hashes. And it's just fun, too. So that is what we are covering in Basics Episode 2. Let's take a quick moment, hit our sponsors for today, and then we will get into this one. Oh my freaking God! I had no idea. Today, it just dropped that there is a new Cold Card Q1. It has got a full QWERTY keyboard on it. It has got a QR code scanner and a huge color screen. So the already super versatile Cold Card just added a camera and a big screen to be able to do QR code scanning. Which I think that means that it has like every mode of communication that I think any hardware wallet has. That's crazy. I don't know, but I just read about it this morning. You've got to check it out. I'll have a link to the Bitcoin Magazine article in the show notes, and I'm pretty sure you can get a 9% discount on it with my code Bitcoin Audible. I haven't checked, but I will have it in the show notes as well. And then when you super geek out and you buy a Cold Card Q1 like myself, you're going to want to stack sats on Swan Bitcoin and send it straight to your new Cold Card. Swan Bitcoin is the place to onboard onto Bitcoin. Please don't go to an exchange. Please don't do a Google search. And in fact, this is something we'll probably cover in the basics, is don't Google search anything unless you know exactly what you're going to find. Like, you can Google search for Swan Bitcoin, but don't Google search for places to buy Bitcoin. Just go to Swan Bitcoin. And I will actually get into why I think that Google searches for generic things always have the worst results. And Swan Bitcoin is such a great resource to get to so many different things and to understand, like podcasts and shows and more information and hardware wallets, etc. Just go to Swan Bitcoin and start there. And I'll explain in a navigating the Bitcoin world basics episode, which is coming, why the Google search situation is just bad. And then lastly, you're going to stack with Fold, because stacking with your debit card with sats back on everything that you buy is just, it just feels like magic. It's just free sats. It gets sats all the time. And it is so awesome to feel like I stack sats in so many different ways. I'm mining now. I get sats back on my Fold debit card. I get sats back on Fold gift cards that I get for places, even when I'm going out to them. I get sats every day on the spin wheel. I get sats on my auto buy on Swan Bitcoin. I get sats on Value for Value and you guys on Fountain who are boosting and sending us. I love stacking sats. And Fold is a critical piece of that mission. Stack sats on freaking everything. Get yourself the Fold premium debit card. GuySwan.com/Fold. Right there in the show notes. All right. So again, I don't want to get overly technical, but you know, you don't have to know how a bank account number and routing number and, you know, passwords, you don't have to know how they work to, you know, just be able to follow the instructions that somebody else gives you to enter this or that. But I much prefer going through life knowing the main functions of what is going on. And I hate feeling helpless and feeling like I need to rely on someone else's instruction or judgment about a situation in order to make a decision, in order to move forward. And I think we should all know about how all of the things in our lives work, at least their basic operation, all the things that make us sustained, like how we get our food, how the things in my house work, how the, you know, the main pieces of the AC that could break. Like, I think that's the important, like, that's what we should learn in school, for crying out loud. That childlike fascination that we have when, like, that Rad has with everything that is, like, right in front of him. Like, we all have that. We just want to know what everything in front of us is, how it comes to be, and how it works. And it's a tragedy that school beats that desire right out of us and shoves us into a 20-year mindless game of repeat after me. But I digress. You guys, if you've been listening to the show, you know my take on education already, probably. Quote unquote education. But there are some things that we can understand well enough just by knowing how to relate to them in Bitcoin. You know, just a wallet, what keys are and how to treat them. But the one thing that I feel like we should understand a little bit more in depth is the good old hash function. Hashes are everywhere in Bitcoin. Actually, hashes are just everywhere in general on the internet and computers. But in Bitcoin, transactions are hashed, addresses are hashed, Signatures are hashed, keys are hashed, transactions are hashed together, different scripts and signatures are hashed together, blocks are hashed, and there's a giant hash race that the network performs to hash valid Bitcoin blocks over and over and over again. Literally, it's like sextillions of numbers of times per second collectively as a network, as fast as absolutely hashing possible. And sextillion is exahashes. I think that's right. So sextillion is actually the number of hashes per second. It's not trillion, not quadrillion, not quintillion, sextillions of hashes every single second. So get ready. Get ready to hear the word hash.
Hashing.
Hashing.
Hashes.
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 Hashing.
Just a hash, man.
A lot. So get familiar with it. Taste it on your tongue. Hash. So let's hash it out. So, what the fuck is a hash? So without actually doing any math, a hash is a computational fingerprint. It's a way to do math, for your computer to do math, to verify that a piece of information is the piece of information that it is. It is a fingerprint. It's a little block of data that can act like proof of a piece of data without actually having to see or deal with what the data is, like the whole piece of data itself. You can mess around with the fingerprints and then relate to the data when you need it. So just like a fingerprint in real life can represent you as a user on your iPhone or Google Pixel or whatever it is, or say your fingerprint shows up in an oily display on the side of a wine glass sitting mere feet away from a scene of gruesome murder. Well, with just that little piece of information, your fingerprint, tiny little splotch of oil, we know that your entire person was at said location, and obviously you are a murderer. Well, hashes are kind of like that for the stuff on your computer, except that your files don't murder people, and you just need to figure out where a particular file is in an absolutely massive bucket of zeros and ones on your hard drive. Fingerprints are useful here. Hashing is like it's a little trick of cryptography that is just insanely useful. You use them all the time to... It helps keep the internet working. It keeps databases organized. You're using it all the time and you have no idea. For example, like with websites, with a password to a website, they are generally stored and checked not as their passwords, not as the plain text password. They're usually dealt with as hashes because you just don't want to be blasting naked passwords out across the internet all the time. So generally, you type your password into the box on the website in your web browser, on your computer. Your web browser, Brave, Chrome, Firefox, Safari, will hash it on your computer, and then it will send the hash. It will send the result. It will send the fingerprint to the server, and then that server knows that you had the password at the other end, even though it might not necessarily need to see it. You didn't have to receive the password from you. It just used the hash to prove that the password was over there on your computer. So it just compares the fingerprint rather than having to send the sensitive data. If, of course, it already has the sensitive data. So another example, you know, digital signatures themselves are a form of a hash. So anytime you've had to verify or sign a document or any like fraud detection stuff online, tons and tons of places and reasons to use hashes in all of that. Another good example, if you've ever downloaded something off of BitTorrent, like using a file sharing thing, have you ever wondered how you could possibly download a single file in just tons of tiny little chunks completely out of order from like hundreds of different people on the internet, and yet you knew that each little piece was exactly the little piece you were looking for, you knew where to put it in the exact right file, and that it fit in the exact right slot in the exact right order? Hashing, my man. They do it with hashing. Ever compressed a file? Well, there's a lot of hashing going on there, too. Networking, like load balancing. So when networks are like organizing and distributing connections like across a network, to particular servers. Like, let's say Google has like 20 servers all over the country. How do you know which one to connect to? And how do they know which one to route you to? And how do they take your connection from one and connect it to another without having to do the handshake all over and disconnect and reconnect? Well, there may or may not be hashing involved in a lot of those different steps as well. And then, of course, indexing. Just listing out where every, how to find stuff on the internet, like search functions. Like when you go to Google, you know, what they do is they scour everything on the internet, right? They find connections, they find websites and images and text, and then they hash the living crap out of all of it and they put it into a giant hash table. Because if they were just keeping records of where everything was and, you know, had to keep every single word, like how would you denote that this thing is in this word exactly without just having to keep a record of where, like a separate link for every single word? It basically means that you have to go through as much information as the entire internet to look up where things are on the entire internet, which defeats the purpose of having a search. If that was efficient, we would just do it. We wouldn't need a search. We could just blast out connections to everything on the freaking internet and just be like, who's got that flu chart of the numbers disappearing in 2020? I'm gonna check this website. Is it there? No, it's not there. I'm gonna check this blog about cakes. Is it there? Nope, it's not there. Let me check this next one. That doesn't sound very efficient. You need to know where those things are, and you need to know it in a way that you don't have to go through a link for every single piece. Like, how could you shorten that path? Well, you hash collections of hashes. You hash up a tree of combine two things, hash them, combine two things, hash them, and there's a little trick of the hash that you can do, basically reverse math, and just see where in this giant hash table something is, and rather than having to check a million different options, in a tree of hashes, you can maybe check six different steps down this tree and have eliminated a million options that don't have the word you're looking for. Checking fingerprints is a whole lot faster than checking all the stuff every single time. So this is a little tangent, but this is a really cool way to use this, and I've been so stoked about this system since I found it. But I have an app on my Mac. It's a really useful tool called Hook Productivity, or Hook Mark. I'm not sure. The thing is Hookmark. I think they're trying to change the name, and they've still got both of them. It's hookproductivity.com. But anyway, it lets you make a universal link to like an app, a file, a folder, basically anything on my computer that I can just paste into like a note. So it's like a link like on the web. And you can just like click on a word and go to it. I can do that for stuff on my computer. And I use a note app called Obsidian, which basically will just format and read these links. As it's referred to as markdown, but it just means that you can click on stuff. And there's like a bunch of different formatting and things that you can do, but it's just a type of note. And it lets you have links. So when I write notes throughout the day and save stuff on my computer, I can, like for instance, the ones on this show, every single day I'm opening up a note and I'm making, you know, saving quotes and writing down thoughts and, you know, details and things for the show in a text file in a note, and I actually put links to the files that I need or that are related to it. Like I have a link in the note to the file on my computer for this show. So while I'm in my notes, I can just click on it and then boom, it brings up the file in front of me. I don't have to remember where I put it in on my computer. Same with like the effects that I use, like the sensor beep or something, like anything that I need for episodes pretty regularly, I just put it in the template for my note for the episode. So that the link is just there. But what it does is it kind of lets me navigate my computer like I navigate the web. But the coolest thing about it is that it creates its own index, its own little hash table of all the files' locations, and it's based on the actual data of the file, not its path, which is what a lot of things use. So if you ever use, like, you import something into, like, a program, like an editing program or something that you're using, and then you move it to a new location, it's like, dude, what'd you do with the file? And then it's like, broken link, and you have to go find it. Well, with a hashing trick that just ignores the path, but makes its own index, the hookmark link, I can make a episode for today's podcast and just throw it on the desktop and leave it named untitled, make a link for it, put it in today's notes, and then later I can change the name to, you know, Basics 02, Hashes and Proof of Work, and move it to my podcasting folder, and then the, you know, the Basics subfolder, whatever. And when I go back to the link in my notes, it still takes me to that new location and the new file name. It just knows that it's the same file because fingerprints. So needless to say, hashes are useful. But there are a couple of gritty details we need to know about these hashes. Some characteristics that are really important that aren't just explained with this, with the analogy, it's a fingerprint. First and foremost, it is a one-way function. You can't go backwards. When you make this fingerprint, just like I can't take my fingerprint, like an oily fingerprint in like a room, I can't take that fingerprint and then know what color hair I have. Like I can't take that fingerprint and then, you know, stick it in a 3D printer and then print a perfect copy of a person. Like that fingerprint doesn't really tell me anything about who I am or any details about the person other than the fact that if you have the fingerprint to prove it's the person, the fingerprint is a match. It says that person is here, but you need to have details about that person elsewhere, because you can't study my fingerprint and find out if I'm a man or a woman, or how tall I am, what my build is like, the color of my skin, like nothing. There's no other characteristics that arise out of the fingerprint. It's just the fact, it just matches me. Similar to that, the hash doesn't tell us anything about the item. You know, if we were transferring, that's one of the reasons you use hashes instead of just naked passwords, is because the hash verifies that the password was there, but nobody can look at the hash and be like, oh, the password has the number 7 in it. There's nothing about the hash that says anything about the underlying data that created it. You can't take the hash and get the message back out of it. But the message will always create the hash. So that is referred to as a one-way function. It goes forward, but you can't take the result and get back to where you started. Another important characteristic, uniform size. The hash is always the same size. So like based on the algorithm you use, there's kind of a bunch of different flavors of hashing, MD5 and SHA-1 and SHA-256 and blah, blah, blah. But they're all the same size if they're the same flavor. So Bitcoin uses SHA-256, which means that every hash is 256 bits long, which when you're dealing with it in, you're encoding it in a different type of data, it ends up being 64 characters. But it's 256 bits as in zeros and ones on your computer. But this is why dealing with a hash is just so much easier than dealing with the data itself. Not only can you do some fun math tricks with it, but the fingerprint is always the size of a finger. You know, like you could keep a database of fingerprints a whole lot better than you can keep a database of millions of people, right? Like you could maybe fit a million fingerprints in a couple of 3-ring binders. But how big would the room have to be if you were trying to shove a million people into it? Well, it's kind of the same way with hashes and the underlying data. So a little aside just on terminology, because I don't want to... Some jargon feels necessary, but just for the sake of anyone who is just not familiar with this language, the geek stuff at all, encoding just means translating. It's the exact same information, just like given in a different form. So English, like if I wanted to say, how do I go to the bathroom? I can say it in Spanish. I can quote unquote encode it in English or Spanish. But I can also encode it as Morse code. You know, when I'm typing out Morse code, you know, there was a very long time where over telecommunications lines, the only thing we knew how to send over it was an interruption of an electrical signal. Hence, beep, 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 Morse code. But all they're actually sending is letters, right? They're just encoding it as random strings of short and long beeps. But the point is to send letters that they can then stick together into words. For example, SOS is... short, 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 long, 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 short, short, short. So if you ever remember any Morse code, SOS is probably, like, that's it. Like, that's probably the biggest one with the biggest asymmetric payoff versus cost. You never know when you're in a situation in which you have extremely limited communication or all you have is a flashlight and somebody is way too far away. If you can remember short, 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 long, 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 short, 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 hey, it might save your life one day. Or maybe you're the one on the boat. Maybe you're the one that's too far away and you see the message and you know to interpret. You're like, who's flashing a freaking light? Maybe you recognize short, 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 long, 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 short, short, short. SOS. Somebody's in trouble. All other Morse code is useless. Encoding is just displaying the information in a different way. Okay, back to hashes. So they are of a uniform size. You get the same output no matter how big the information or small the information is. So if I did a SHA-256 hash of the entire database of Wikipedia or YouTube for that matter, if I took all the YouTube videos, petabytes of data, every single pixel, and I hashed the entire thing, I would still just get the 64 characters. And if you had the entire database of YouTube on your computer, your local machine, and you hashed it, you would get the exact same thing. The same 64 characters. And then I could send you those 64 characters, or you could send me your 64 characters, and we could actually verify that we both had the exact same data. That's a whole lot easier than checking each other's entire database. That's like gigameg blocks worth of information. But you're just checking little 64 character string. And that also is true if you just hash a single character or a single word. For instance, you can use SHA-SUM-A256 in your terminal, like in just a command window on your computer, and you can hash anything on your computer, and you can get those, you can test it out. I like, it's like two steps, really easy, but I'll put it in the show notes. I'm not going to speak it out on audio. That's not very good UX. But if you look in the description and you want to try it out, it'll have step one, open up your terminal. Step two, enter this command. But the hash of the letter H, which I just performed, is 44BD7AE60F4 blah, 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 and a whole bunch of other characters. Even though it was just the letter H, it's the same size every time. Now, another important characteristic is it's deterministic, which means that as long as you have the same input, you're hashing the same book, the same YouTube database, no matter where it is, whether it's on my computer or your computer, if it's the same information, the hash is the same. However, it is also random. Just like the going back to the one-way function, you can't guess it ahead of time. The only way to know what the shortest path to acquiring the hash is hashing it. You know, if my fingerprint, if I'm the same person, but if my fingerprint changed every single month, well, it wouldn't do us much good. I want it to stay the same if I am trying to identify me as a person. Well, that is the same with the data. The fingerprint can't change if the data hasn't changed. And if the data has changed, the fingerprint really needs to change. So if I change even the teeny tiniest piece of it, I put one space in one video description in all of the entire petabytes upon petabytes of YouTube database and hash that instead of the regular YouTube database, but the one with the extra space or the extra period or whatever, the new hash will look nothing at all like the old one. Comparing them would give absolutely no indication that the two things that were hashed were 99.99999% the exact same. They would look as different as if I hashed a copier scan of my butt with the entire database of YouTube. And if I put all three of them next to each other, the entire petabytes of YouTube database, the entire petabyte of YouTube database with one character changed and the photocopier scan of my butt, and I put those hashes next to each other, they would all look equally unique. All hashes are created equal and independent. And then again, that randomness, it's also, and the fact that it's a one-way function means that it's the same reason that, you know, I can't tell that the hash of a 99.9999% YouTube is the same as the YouTube hash. I also can't get 99% of YouTube and then guess, like, know anything about what the hash of the rest of YouTube might be. The only thing I can do is have all of the relevant data and calculate it myself. And I need every single character. This is a crucial thing to keep in mind as we frame how the Bitcoin system works and how hashes constantly play a recurring role in every single thing we do. So, hashes are a fingerprint of the data. Hashes are one-way functions. You can't take the hash and recreate the data. They are random. You cannot know beforehand until you just run the hash what you're going to get on the other side of it. They are uniform. They are always the same size, and they are deterministic. If you have the exact same input, you are always going to get the exact same output. A final important piece of this is that they are referred to as quote-unquote collision-resistant. The space of possible hashes, like the 64 characters, the number of different options is so vast that no two pieces of data are going to ever produce the same hash. Or at least it's so unlikely that we would expect the universe to die out in a heat death before we find a collision. We're just talking about really, really big numbers. This is what ensures that every single one that you see is unique to exactly the data that it represents. So now that we know some things about hashes, let's talk about proof of work. And let's pause for just a second and thank our sponsor for the day. If you want to know what's going on in the Bitcoin space, you should go to Swarm Bitcoin. If you want to learn how to use Bitcoin and how to think about Bitcoin, you should go to Swarm Bitcoin. If you want to buy Bitcoin, you should definitely go to Swarm Bitcoin. If you want to listen about Bitcoin, you should stay here at Bitcoin Audible, but also you can get a curated list of kind of the fundamentals over at Swarm Bitcoin. And not just of my show, but curated lists of content around any topic that you can think of from all of the best writers and educators in the space at the Swan Bitcoin Canon. And I have an automatic purchase that I do with Swan, and I've had it for a very, very long time now. It does $200 every single week, and it automatically sends it to my cold storage. And I think practically everybody in my immediate family has a Swan Bitcoin savings plan of some sort. And even if you can't afford a lot, everybody can do $5, $10, and that makes a difference. I promise you it builds up. I know that from experience. Everybody out there can put away $5, $10 a week. And if you do it automatically, if you do it first, knowing that that cost is just going to be there, because you are going to pay your future self Bitcoin today, your future self will love you for having set that up, for having gone to Swan Bitcoin. SwanBitcoin.com/guy is my referral as well. That'll help you support the show also. But you turn on your low time preference, you put on your long-term big boy pants, and you start an automatic Bitcoin savings plan with whatever you can afford. I promise, you'll thank me later. SwanBitcoin.com/guy, you'll find it in the show notes. So as we explain a bunch of other things, and like we talk about addresses and wallets and keys and all that stuff, which will probably be in the next episode, I want to really get into like very practical things, even though this is kind of the stuff I geek out on pretty hard. But you'll just hear the word hash a lot. So I want this to be a really good foundation. So what is proof of work? Proof of work is just a whole bunch of hashing. So proof of work was invented in like 93. I can't remember. It's like Dvorak and somebody. Man, I should have looked that up. I'll have the Wikipedia page, a link to it or something. But this all easily searchable, so there's no reason to memorize. But it was in the early 90s sometime, and then like mid to late 90s, Adam Back used it in Hashcash, which was one of the precursors to Bitcoin. But it was essentially used as email spam prevention. And essentially all it does is it requires you to have a provable piece of computation attached to your email, to your message, which just means it delays you just a little bit. It just gives a very small cost to sending out an email, which if you're sending out one email or 10 emails, it's no big deal. But if you're spam, the reason spam works is because you just blast it out endlessly to a million people and you try to catch the, you know, five fools who fall for it. But if you have to do 1 second's worth of computation in order to send out that email, well, a normal user sending one email wouldn't even notice it. Somebody sending out 10 emails to, like, an email to 10 different people, will have to sit there and look at a spinny wheel for a second. But somebody sending out 1 million spam emails, that's like 12 days. And so Hashcash was this idea of creating these provable tokens, which were just hashes, with a certain degree of rarity. So when you create a hash, again, you don't know what the result is going to be. But let's say you wanted a result with that started with the number 5. Well, back to that hash that I talked about earlier with the hash of the letter H. It was 44BD7AE. Maybe I want to have a hash that starts with the number 5. Well, I have to change something because I can't, if I hash H again, it's just going to be the exact same number. So I'm going to put this field over to the side, just this additional thing that's just a counter. It just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's arbitrary. It's there for every single thing. My message is H. And this counter is just there so that I can keep hashing and get a different result, and I just count up the counter. Because again, if I just change one number, one character, I get a completely different hash. So I'm going to do this right now. I'm going to see how many it takes. So I did H1, and I got a hash that started with an 8B. All right, so we're going to do H2. Starts with the letter A. Okay, it was 18, H18. I was actually getting a little worried there. But I just did proof of work. I wanted to hash the message H, and I wanted to, and let's say someone else required it of me, to produce a hash that had the number 5. Well, no one who doesn't really want to send you a message is going to go through that. I mean, granted, I did it manually, but if you require the computer to do that and it has to do this computation, again, I couldn't guess which one. I had no idea that 18 was going to be it. I couldn't predict that 18 was going to be it. All I could do was try. So imagine if we want to have an analogy to be able to picture this, is that let's say you're a club and like you run a nightclub and the club is incredibly busy and it's super, super popular, and you know you're going to have a flood of people coming in, and they're going to come in too quickly. So what you do is you sit at the door and you just say, you give the next person in line a set of dice, and you say, you have to roll snake eyes before you can come inside. Each die has a 1 in 6 chance of rolling a 1, and you want both die to roll a 1 at exactly the same time. And by doing that, you slow down the line, because everybody who comes up to the door now has to wait, you know, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, whatever it takes for them to roll snake eyes. Now, if people are staying too long and you've filled up the place and you're still bringing too many people in faster than they are going out, you can make them roll snake eyes twice. You can, quote unquote, change the difficulty of them being able to get in the room. But here's the interesting thing, is that because the proof of work is proof that no one cheated the game of dice, like the hash function cannot be cheated, you can't guess ahead of time, you could automate this process without someone managing it. If you've ever heard the term difficulty adjustment, that's what that is. And the difficulty adjustment specifically is really one of the most elegant things that it's really kind of the missing piece that didn't exist anywhere else that Satoshi truly made. Like Bitcoin is an amalgamation of so many disparate ideas that kind of had one little piece of the puzzle. Hashcash being one of them. In fact, it is actually Adam Back's it's essentially Adam Back's proof of work function. It's obviously it's adapted to Bitcoin, but he took a lot of these core ideas from so many of these other attempts at creating digital cash, and he kind of found the secret sauce that stuck them all together in such a way that they each did the job they were trying to accomplish. But they did it as a singular system. And there were no outside parties. There's no centralized coordinator. And like we talked about in the first basics episode, that Bitcoin is, it's essentially a big ledger that has a new block of data added to it every 10 minutes. And this is how you regulate every 10 minutes. Now, it's not actually every 10 minutes. It's probabilistic. So it's an average. So one block might take an hour. I mean, just like you have no idea how long it's going to take for someone to get through the door rolling snake eyes. But if 200 people came through the door in as many minutes, 200 minutes, then even though there were like five people who rolled it on the first try, and then another 10 people that took 5 minutes apiece, it averaged out over 200 different people to be 1 minute apiece. So based on what you knew about those 200 people going through the door in there, the quickness by which they could roll snake eyes, you can actually stretch that out to 2 minutes. You can know, okay, well, this is the rough probability I need for two. I need roughly twice that probability. This is essentially what happens with Bitcoin blocks, is the issuance schedule. Every time a new block of Bitcoin comes in, a new amount of Bitcoin is allowed to exist in the world or be accessible on the network. They are quote-unquote mined. But how do you regulate how difficult it's going to be to mine those Bitcoin when you have no idea how many people are going to be on the network? You have no idea how many people are going to be running their machines. You need to have a permissionless system, because that's the whole point of the system to begin with, is that you need to be able to freely join and leave. You need to be able to start mining for Bitcoin without asking anybody's permission. And you need to be able to mine without even, like, the network doesn't even know that you're mining until you publish a valid block, until you publish the valid hash. In my silly example, it was the hash that started with the number 5. But in the way Bitcoin works is that you have leading zeros at the beginning of your hash. And I have no idea, like, the difficulty is so high when you have literally sextillions in hashes per second. Well, then you have, like, I don't know, 15 zeros at the beginning. I have no idea. But it's like rolling snake eyes. Well, it's like rolling nothing but ones on, you know, 15 dice at once. Well, somebody might be rolling dice without anybody letting anybody know. Like, I need to be able to go to literally, and the way the system works is I could go to Antarctica, I could sit in a room, and I could just roll dice until I got 15, 15 ones on 15 dice at exactly the same time. But nobody knows I'm doing that. However, when I get it, if I have an internet connection in any way, shape, or form, I can get it out to the network, and I win those Bitcoin. I am the miner of the next piece, next block of information that is stuck to the Bitcoin chain, the next block of transactions. And the network, all of the other nodes can verify. They don't have to do the proof of work over, because the hash that starts with the number 5 is the proof that you only have to do that one hash. So verifying that the work was done is insanely easy. It's just checking the answer. So perfect example was what I did with the letter H earlier, as I hashed it 18 times. And I will have the command that you can punch in your terminal or your command line. I'll have that right in the show notes, and you can check it yourself. H18 produces the hash 522E67D blah, blah, blah. And you'll see it on your own computer. Now, when I'm mining as proof of work for Bitcoin, what I'm hashing is the block of transactions that's being aggregated from the entire network. But here's the real beauty of what proof of work does. So it averages out among everybody who is producing blocks. So it's not any individual's likelihood of finding a block. It's all of the individuals hashing at exactly the same time likelihood of finding a block, which means the probability takes into account everybody's hash power. So it's not that any individual user is expected to find a block every 10 minutes. It's that with everyone in the entire world trying to find a block, somebody somewhere in this giant lottery is only expected to find a block roughly once every 10 minutes. And like my example of it adjusts every time 200 people go into the club, the nightclub. Well, in Bitcoin's case, it's 2016 blocks, which is about 2 weeks at 10 minutes per block. So now that we know what proof of work is, or we have an image of what proof of work is, and we understand what the hash function is, let's go back to the abstract of the Bitcoin white paper and read the section about proof of work. Okay, quote, "We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. The network timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof of work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof of work." Okay, so what does he mean by that? So after the proof of work is stamped on the latest batch of transactions in Bitcoin, and a valid one is found, which again took the entire planet 10 minutes to find. I mean, maybe an hour, maybe 1 minute, but for the last 2016 blocks, on average, it was 10 minutes apiece. It stamps those blocks in, and everyone, all the rules of everybody's node, accepts that the longest chain, the one with the latest block with the valid hash on it, the valid proof of work, is the correct chain. The magic is the fact that we have a way with no coordinator, no permission, no privilege, no bias, no subjectivity, a perfect way to just agree on what the going state of Bitcoin is. And if you want to change a block that has already been hashed, that a valid proof of work has already been found, well, then you need to produce two blocks, because you need to be, your chain needs to be longer than the one, than any other one with a valid block. And you can quote unquote orphan it because now your chain is longer. So if you wanted to undo a transaction that already got stamped into the chain with a proof of work, is you have to outpace the entire planet's worth of hash power by yourself. You need to redo the hash on their block and get the next one before the rest of the world, before anybody in the world finds another block. And thus, the record cannot be changed. The history of Bitcoin cannot be altered without redoing the proof of work that is already stamped on the previous blocks. And this means that the cost of manipulating Bitcoin, of altering the history, is massive. And most importantly, it's real. It's not fake. It can't be cheated. It's not permissioned. There's no special person who can demand we all follow a block without the proof of work. The only thing the nodes care about is the proof of work. The longest proof of work chain, the data itself, stands as proof of the legitimate state of the Bitcoin network. And you don't have to care what node you got it from. You don't have to care whether it was over satellite or radio or if the CIA owned the network or whatever. If you can see the valid proof of work, you know somebody did the proof of work. You know somebody spent enormous amount of energy creating it. And that is why it is trustless. And it is all done with the magic of hashing. It's a very simple tool, but with very, very important and very specific characteristics that can just be used in an incredible way. Back to the abstract. The longest chain not only serves as proof of the sequence of events witnessed, but proof that it came from the largest pool of CPU power. As long as a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network, they will generate the longest chain and outpace attackers. So essentially, every honest miner who is trying to find the next block simply need to outweigh anyone trying to replace the last block. And because there's no coordination involved in the actual process, there's this elegant, like, kind of reverse prisoner's dilemma. So the prisoner's dilemma is that it's a really foundational game theory thought experiment. But the prisoner's dilemma is you've got two prisoners that are being interrogated, and they were both in cahoots and they committed a crime, and they're being told to rat out on their buddy, but they can't talk with their buddy. But whether or not they rat them out, their sentence changes drastically. So let's say it's you and me. If we rat each other out, then we each get 5 years in prison. If you betray me, if you rat me out, you go free, but I get 10 years in prison. If I betray you, I get to go free, and you get 10 years in prison. If we both remain silent, if neither one of us betrays the other, we both get 2 years in prison. So the optimal strategy for the pair of us in regards to jail overall jail time is to both remain silent. But the optimal individual strategy is to rat the other person out. But because of that, you're more likely to rat the other person out, even if you don't want to, because you have to worry that they are going to rat you out. Like, I have to worry that if I don't rat you out and you do rat me out, I go to prison for 10 years. So essentially, we're basically incentivized to screw each other over, even though we don't want to, even if we don't want to. So the proof of work function, the apparatus in the Bitcoin network, because it creates this enormous cost, it's like a force field around the past, like literally a computational force field. Like, you have to use energy, you have to hash away at a computer to defeat the wall of the hash wall and go backward into the history of Bitcoin, while the rest of the planet is trying to go forward. Is trying to add the next block to the time chain while I am trying to go backward, and I'm competing against them, which means that I have an enormous cost for trying to betray everybody while I can get a reward for just trying to beat everybody going forward honestly. So it sets up an internal game theory in the Bitcoin network to essentially force people to cooperate even if they don't want to. And it literally uses everyone's self-interest, everyone's desire to get the best outcome with the least cost, as the weapon to encourage cooperation. So that's what hashes and proof of work do in the Bitcoin system. So I know that one got a little bit deep, and hopefully it didn't get too technical. But hashing and proof of work, I think, is really important because there's so many other places where we're going to see it, like Bitcoin addresses and script hashes and like these sorts of things, which we might not go into like insane detail on those sorts of things unless you want to. But I'll have that probably a little bit further down the line. Because I want to keep up the basics episode and just kind of like find another topic, because there's just an endless string of things that we could get into. I mean, we could cover the entire Mastering Bitcoin book like this if you wanted. I mean, I don't have an end date. I'm just going to keep teaching until people get sick of the Bitcoin Basics series. But I do want to get back to much more practical stuff, because I think after you appreciate that Bitcoin does work, and you kind of understand, you're familiar with some of the major functions as to why it actually provides you the assurance. Like, when you get a transaction that someone sent to you and it is confirmed on the network, the only way for them to undo that is if they spend more energy and more computation than the entire global Bitcoin network combined in order to try to get your transaction removed. There is no other payment or settlement system in the world that can even come close. In fact, they're not even comparable because everything else is based on trust. There's literally someone who owns the system. Like Visa, there are always people who can reverse it infinitely. When it comes to Bitcoin exchange, a transaction that you have received or sent, and Bitcoin ownership, Bitcoin is like a tank in a world of tricycles. And after you kind of get your head around that, another good one just kind of fascinating storytelling around just a lot of these elements in Bitcoin, which we'll be covering in various degree, but just a fun exploration of it all that was a really, really fun read, really fun narration of mine was Dergigi's 21 Lessons. I recommend it all the time, but that's just another one to go back to. I even go back and listen to myself read it from time to time because the book's just that good. So I highly recommend that if you want something like really entertaining that hits a lot of basic ideas. Like if you don't have an aha moment at some point listening to that, then Bitcoin is not for you, and you just need to cut your losses and get out. But I'll have the link to that in the show notes as well. But next time we are going to get into more hands-on in the sense that like we will be talking about things that you interact with. You don't really interact with proof of work or hashes. You see the result of them all the time, even though you might not know it. But what do you see when you actually use Bitcoin? You know, what's a wallet? What's a node? Should I set up a node? Do I have to set up a node? Do I have to mine? So that's the kind of stuff we're going to cover in the next couple of episodes of The Basics. So let me know what you thought. Drop me some feedback. Feel free to boost in Fountain. We're going to be reading a piece on Noster or Noster tomorrow, an article that I just saw recently from Walker, a good friend of mine from the Crypto Couple. They are hilarious if you do not know them. We will have that tomorrow. So if you wanted to boost in, is it Noster or is it Noster? Let me know if you have a preference. I think I'm going to do Noster, but we'll see. I'll let the Fountain boosters decide. Or actually, if you have another one, I don't know. Is there another way to pronounce it? But we'll be getting into it tomorrow. So thank you guys for listening. Do not forget to subscribe. A thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite, and the new Cold Card Q1. I am really stoked about this. I can't believe I found out about this like 20 minutes before I started recording today. The link will definitely be in the show notes for that. So do not forget to check it out. 9% off with my code. And then lastly, Fold and the Fold Card. To let me stack sats on everything in my life. Thank you guys for supporting the show and for letting me do this because I love this stuff. And thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed this one, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. R. Buckminster Fuller.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.